SCP-8888 8 Ball Part 2. The SCP Foundation does not typically get robbed. It's happened, of course, but typically the immense amount of protocols and security measures that the Foundation employs for anything that might be worth stealing deters any would-be criminals. That goes even further for the really secure stuff. And with SCP-8888, we're informed about perhaps the most secure object the Foundation possesses, a miraculous device that they use to solve their problems by essentially predicting the future. SCP-8888 was practically impossible to steal, and by all accounts, shouldn't have been capable of being stolen, and yet, stolen it was, by unknown individuals. Now, Dr. Sokolsky has been granted authority by the O5 Council to put together a team to steal it back, a decision that they certainly may come to regret. Let's continue. We pick things up where we left off, with Sokolsky about to assemble his team in order to recover the 8-Ball. With that, he begins in Greece, descending down the steps of an ancient Greek theater at night. On a stage constructed of warm wood paneling, an eccentrically dressed woman is currently giving a lecture, gesturing at a holographic display to her left, displaying a three-dimensional model of the fallen city around her in its prime. She speaks to a drone hovering nearby, stating that the war between the Mechanite Empire and classical Hellas is a mote in the corner of our eye. When we examine the sources straight on, we can't so much as glimpse it. It is only perceptible as a faint irritation on the surface of our lens. The facts of this conflict can only be glimpsed peripherally, and this presents challenges which only a trained historioglyphicist is equipped to meet. The model zooms to reveal the streets of ancient Tiresios, which collapse and crumble to match the present-day contours. The speaker, Dr. Azalea Moncier, gestures at each ruined structure as the virtual camera passes them by. She continues, stating that there are signs and symbols etched in these stones which the naked eye cannot perceive. They range from radioactive isotopes to shaped Gaussian offal, and at the time of their creation, only individuals enhanced with crude cybernetics could glimpse and decode them. Here is the fragmented record left by Agatha of Eritrea, a traveling bard who charmed her way into the statesman's citadel and marked each residence for strategic bombardment, lighting up the landscape with nothing but a decanter of charmed pomegranate juice for the benefit of her colleagues and their precision artillery on a far distant hill. Here are the warning signs left by the Cryptides, a trio of brothers who encoded the paths of Scythian archers and city officials so that their comrades could avoid or confront them as the need arose. She waves at the model, and the collapsed portions reform at half transparency. She continues, saying that here, on the rooftops and gutters, we could witness the blazing trail of the great and nameless master assassin who opened the western gate and ensured the city's fall, if not for the fact that the evidence was reduced to rubble by that same cataclysm. She smiles as Sokolsky reaches the stage, but does not look at him. Her eyes are glossy and pale. She states that it took a team of anastylosists 2 years to restore the facades on a single line of houses, reconstructing against every law of architecture to match the alterations the assassin's reality-bending footfalls made as she bounded from tile to fortuitously repositioned tile, meticulously scrying each stone under the right combinations of starlight and moonlight. And one historioglyphicist an evening with red wine and candlelight to interpret the results into a history the ancient Greeks had expunged with prejudice. She smiles even wider and says that history interprets the pages of the past. Historiography interprets the pages of history. Historioglyphics turns the pages upside down, reads the emptiness in the margins and the spaces between the lines. in retrieving these truths from the space beyond spaces to when they were blasted, perhaps we might prevent ourselves from becoming subjects of the same most physically strenuous field of study. The drone then ceases to whir and falls gently to the dusty floor as the hologram disappears. Sokolsky approaches her and asks where the assassin was headed after the gates. Monsieur turns to face him without making eye contact and replies, "The Temple of Octo, where the paths of all her friends not coincidentally converged once their less occluded tasks were done. When they first discovered their total expunction from the Hellenistic Chronicles, they assumed it was an act of revenge for their part in the city's fall. It turns out that it was just one long, complex distraction to cover up a simple act of theft from the temple's reliquary." Sokolsky nods and says that there's no points for guessing what they stole then. Monsieur shakes her head and says that there's never any points for guessing, so she'll let him explain what he's doing here, doubling the population of vanished Tiresios. Sokolsky replies that he's here to heist her, causing her to laugh, and says that it's not a very challenging heist, as she has no guards or countermeasures. Sokolsky waves at the ruins and says, "No, nothing. All by her lonesome in the lostest of lost cities. Someone thinks she's much too valuable to expose to anything weird." He nudges the drone with his foot and asks if she ever tried cracking a safe. She muses that, from a certain point of view, that's all she ever does. She assumes that there's something very valuable in the safe he has in mind. Sokolsky replies that she knows there is, as that was no coincidental lecture she was just delivering. Monsieur giggles and says that he can hardly blame her for indulging in some theater, given the venue. She sighs and says that this is going to be good, as she's waited a long time. Sokolsky raises an eyebrow, asking if she means for someone to steal the eight ball, but she clarifies that she means for a chance to get her hands on it. She's never been allowed, and Sokolsky tells her that she might still not be allowed. They're stealing it back, not manhandling it or asking it 20 questions. She simply replies that at least they'll have proof it exists, and seeing is believing. Sokolsky raises an eyebrow at her, but if she has any way of knowing, she doesn't react. Back in Site 15, as Cimmerian is walking across the site campus and glaring at his phone, he mutters in anger about someone not answering their phone as he's suddenly approached by Sokolsky. Sokolsky just hands him plane tickets without explanation, telling him that he's got an hour to grab his bag and the load. When asked if he understands what he means by the load, Cimmerian guesses he means Hishikaku, to which Sokolsky snaps his fingers and points in affirmation. Cimmerian asks where they're going, and Sokolsky just replies with, "Racking the balls, maybe breaking a few on the way." The next bit of footage is from Sloth's Pit, Wisconsin, as a man in sunglasses is sitting at a picnic table outside of an ice cream shop, eating a vanilla ice cream cone, as Sokolsky sits down across from him. He thanks him for agreeing to meet, to which the man, Dr. Placeholder McDoctorate, retorts that they're the disaster response people, so they don't call unless someone screwed up large. He didn't really have much choice, but Sokolsky says that still, he picked a nice rendezvous spot, a place in the sun. Placeholder scowls and reaches out to shake the table's umbrella for emphasis, saying that it's just a coincidence. Sokolsky nods and says that it's a metaphor for Schadenfreude then, as he'll mock him for whatever went wrong, throwing shade. Placeholder just rolls his eyes and says that this isn't a high school English class, asking him what he wants. Sokolsky tells him that he's putting a big thing together, a world-ending threat response, and since Placeholder ends up stuck in the middle of those half the time, he thought they'd skip the middle step. He then glances up at the restaurant's signage, mentioning that it's called Rocky's Road, and asks if it's a reference to the hero's journey. Placeholder just shrugs, saying that it's an obvious ice cream pun, and he doesn't own the shop. He asks what the big thing is about, and Sokolsky tells him that they're pulling a heist. Placeholder immediately becomes interested, not noticing a scoop of his ice cream falling off, and says that he loves heists. He's always wanted to heist something, and he could talk about heists all day long. Sokolsky just points down at the fallen scoop and asks if the vanilla is a sly reference to his state of perpetual non-protagonism. Placeholder waves the question off, just saying that he likes vanilla, and asks what part he'll get to play, hoping that he's the face, the one responsible for doing most of the talking and social interactions. Sokolsky agrees that he's the face, but considering the nature of the job, the site, and the crew, he's also hoping to lean a bit on his narrativistic crap wherever possible. He then pauses and remarks that this shop is on Frost Street, a self-fulfilling ice cream reference. Placeholder snaps back that it's a Twin Peaks reference and tells him to leave the tropes to the experts. He asks who they are heisting from, to which Sokolsky says, "The Wanderer's Library," remarking that Placeholder has been there before. Placeholder shudders and says that he saw brain spiders on fire off the shoulder of a giant red millipede. Before he can continue, Sokolsky cuts him off, saying to not have any copyright infringement here. Placeholder then asks what the target is, and Sokolsky just counts on his fingers up to 8 and then balls them up into fists with a faint pop. Placeholder immediately stands up, knocking the umbrella aside, and starts yelling about Hishikaku, asking what he did to his site and the hex field. Sokolsky looks up at him curiously, asking what he means by his site, and Placeholder just snorts, saying that he wasn't always the hero's journey guy. He has layers. Sokolsky asks if that's a Neapolitan reference, but Placeholder ignores him, turning to the street, and says that he's in. Sokolsky stands, but instead heads for the ice cream shop, saying that they're ahead of schedule and he's almost never in Wisconsin. It would be bad luck not to grab a few scoops of Blue Moon. As an aside, since this is perhaps the only time I'll ever get to mention Blue Moon, I'll just say that it is the best ice cream flavor, and Sokolsky is absolutely correct. In Site 43, Sokolsky has called a meeting of all the section heads here, and the chairs and chief's boardroom is filled with experts in a variety of anomalous fields and several individuals who are themselves anomalous. Among them are Dr. Lillian Lilyhammer, a medicist with an eidetic memory, Dr. Udo Okori, mycomantic thaumaturge, Dr. Jinyi Du, quantum supermechanist, Dr. Trevor Bremel, anomalous weapons engineer, Dr. Ilsa Reinders, immortal esoteric polymath, and Chief Delfina Ibanez, hyper-competent mobile task forces commander. They all await Sokolsky's arrival. Sokolsky is standing at the topside egress point for Site 43's main elevator, and when it opens, Dr. William Weddle bursts out, falling to the ground in surprise. Sokolsky helps him up and asks if he ran that replication study for him. Weddle dusts himself off and shakes Sokolsky's hand away, swearing and asking why he's here before saying that it's just his luck. Sokolsky laughs and says that Weddle heard he was holding a meeting and he was trying to run away from it, but he should have known better. Weddle replies that the effect doesn't work if he knows better, referring to SCP-7000, which makes him a living bad luck sink. He asks Sokolsky why he's up here, as he thought he lived on site. Sokolsky explains that he's jet-setting, as he's got places to go and people to commandeer. Speaking of which, he asks if Weddle has any time to spare today, causing Weddle to recoil against the elevator door and say that he and Etra nearly ruined his life once already. Sokolsky replies that that would be kind of like ruining the Last Supper. His life has other people's graffiti all over it. He tells him that this way he's already almost out the door, so that's a bonus. If it helps, considering the pickings on offer downstairs, Weddle is obviously not going to be doing anything important for him, but asks again if he ran that replication study. Weddle retrieves his data pad from his lab coat pocket and drops it, although Sokolsky catches it and scrolls to the relevant file. The file is about a pocket billiards table and was tested by Weddle and Dr. Bastian LeBlanc. They attempted to play a regular game of straight pool, with Weddle first attempting 10 break shots, each resulting in a foul or illegal break. LeBlanc breaks for the remainder of the experiment. On his turn in each of the subsequent 19 games, Weddle calls shots on a variety of solid or striped balls as opportunities present themselves, but each game sees his luck progressively worsen, while LeBlanc's improves in equal proportion. Each game ends when Weddle accidentally, prematurely pockets the 8 ball. By the 19th game, Weddle has called every number at least once, save for 13. And on this game, he illegally calls the cue ball, which he does pocket, but also pockets the 8 ball again an instant later. LeBlanc successfully pockets all 16 balls with a single break on the 20th game, the 8 ball pocketed last, then retrieves and racks the balls again. Weddle refuses to continue, so LeBlanc separates the 13 ball from the set and suggests Weddle call it in a single shot. Weddle reluctantly complies, but the resultant shot misses the 13 ball, breaks the racked set, and pockets the 8 ball. He claims victory, but subsequent analysis shows that in his surprise, Weddle failed to remove his cue from the table, altering the paths of several balls, and so pocketing the 8 ball whilst simultaneously fouling is an automatic loss. LeBlanc subsequently reported correctly answering every question on that evening's episode of Jeopardy. Weddle attempts to grab the tablet back from Sokolsky, but it flings out against the elevator doors, and he makes no motion to pick it up. He tells Sokolsky that this is where he says that there's nothing anomalous about the pool table, and Sokolsky agrees, saying that that was all Weddle. They did get a free pool table out of it, though. Weddle argues that he can't play, but Sokolsky just claps him on the back, causing his glasses to fall off, although Sokolsky catches them. He tells him that maybe he just hasn't found the right game. He then calls for the elevator and says that he's off to see the wizards, but he asks Weddle to do him that favor and pick someone up for him, as he's got bigger fish to fry. In the interior of his Wrigley Longship's sacred monitoring room in Site 211, researcher James A. Harkness is sitting asleep with his feet up on his desk. What appears to be a scrapbook sits on his lap, and no other personnel are present. A sound from off-camera wakes him, and he shudders, glancing down at the book and yawning. He then looks at his monitor, rolling his eyes and softly singing himself a song to the tune of Taps, with lyrics related to him not caring about a fish. He opens the scrapbook again, but its contents are obscured by the camera's security filters. There's a loud crashing sound off camera, and Harkness spins in his chair, standing and yelling, "Who goes there?" A voice swears, followed by more clattering sounds and another swear, and as Harkness turns on the lights, Dr. Weddle stumbles into view, with a greenish substance coating his beard. He wipes it off onto the carpet, with it having the consistency of tartar sauce, and he asks what happened in here. Harkness sighs and explains that it's a fish cult, pointing to a whiteboard featuring an array of nautical scribbles and sketches. One phrase is written in bold black marker, circled and underlined many times, continuing onto the wall and across the entire room, reading, "So long, and thanks for all the fish, and all the fish, and all the fish." Harkness continues his explanation, saying it's SCP-5320, a big, dumb fish, and it makes everyone who looks at it too long get a bit rapture of the deep about it. The first week at work, they make fish jokes at each other every couple hours, but months later, they're starting fish rituals. A month after that, they're spending most of every shift propitiating the fish gods, so they've got a rotation going now, where they all get sent on vacation before they get too squirrely, and they leave him to mind the shop. Weddle asks if he's not affected by it, but Harkness says, other than pissing him off, not really. He then yells at Weddle as he looks at the book on the floor, but as Weddle does so, his glasses fall off. He catches them and puts them back on, but they fall off again, and again. And then Harkness tackles him into the whiteboard, yelling that that book is a memetic kill agent sampler. Weddle picks up his glasses and asks if he's doing a little light reading, but Harkness says that that's why he's here, as he's got the highest cognitive resistance value of anyone he's ever met. He's basically immune to kill agents, so fish agents don't even have a chance, and the stuff in this book just gives him bad gas. He's testing out the newest batch as a side gig while he waits for the pool piss to filter out of everyone's brains. Weddle blinks rapidly as he attempts to follow the logic and metaphors, and is reminded of Pool telling Harkness that that's why he's here, because Etra wants him. Harkness narrows his eyes, saying that that can't be right, suggesting maybe it's Reza or AIAD that's interested in him, as he's usually given really crummy jobs due to his CRV value. Weddle confirms that it's definitely Etra, and although Harkness remarks that it's a bit more prestigious than his usual, Weddle tells him that last year they got him kicked into a barbecue by a kangaroo. Harkness nods and says that he'll steal a pair of waders from the locker room just in case. In a club in London, Dr. Sokolsky steps in as the music blares around him, a high, keening wail interspersed with polyphonic madrigals celebrating and/or lamenting the demise of the Hanged King of Alagada. Human, demi-human, and humanoid subjects are dancing, drinking, or engaging in a variety of mating rituals beneath dim and flickering incandescent lights. A pair of golem bouncers lead Sokolsky to a back room, where he finds a demon sitting at an expensive-looking oak table with a briefcase in front of him and a smile on his face. His voice booms as he welcomes Sokolsky, asking if he can get him anything to drink, suggesting that the unpasteurized milk toddy strikes a compelling balance between soporific and gut-wrenching. The escorts depart, and Sokolsky sits down, stating that that's probably meant to be very kind of him to ask, but he declines, as they probably should get down to business. The demon, Razum Kahl, claps his hands together and says that, of course, as Sokolsky has a game to win, and probably more than one if he knows his reputation. Sokolsky removes an envelope from his jacket and says that this is their side of the bargain, the agreement, and he'll find everything is in order from all 13 overseers. The demon nods and mentions the administrator as well, but Sokolsky just replies that there is no such thing. The demon states that he still signed it, to which Sokolsky says that he can't say as he hasn't looked at it. Razum Kahl takes the envelope and examines it, remarking on the unbroken seal and stating that Sokolsky was very careful when he didn't look. He then nudges the briefcase towards the doctor, asking if he wants to examine the merchandise. Sokolsky just shakes his head and says that he trusts him. But after a pause, both of them burst into laughter as Sokolsky opens the briefcase. His face is briefly lit up by what's inside, and he nods, asking if it's been properly laundered. Razum Kahl says, of course, with unstained denominations, genuine human souls in return for his artificial ones, at an almost favorable exchange rate. He asks where they got the originals, as he didn't even know soul NFTs existed, and that's kind of his domain. Sokolsky just says that the most he can tell him is that they don't exist in this universe, or he guesses that they didn't, but they do now, thanks to them. He asks if Razum Kahl has scored them a spot on the invite list, which the demon confirms, although obviously the matter of fake IDs will be their concern. He might have left their circles for his present employment long ago, but his old contacts with corporate are still solid. He does mention that hell's a bit on edge at the best of times, but this is different. They really want the night to go off without a hitch, with egos on the line, potential for hurt feelings, millennia in the sloughing pits, that sort of thing. Sokolsky replies that that's really going to suck for them then, and asks if Razum Kahl will get in too much trouble when it all goes south. The demon shrugs and says that business is business. He threw in his lot with the company, and if he has to burn a few bridges to do right by his present benefactors, then, well, burning is one of his specialties, right under market research. Sokolsky tells him that he's glad he thinks this is a worthwhile investment, as he's paying through the nose for this honor. Razum Kahl, however, says that they gouged them, actually, as privileged access to the 8-Ball is a priceless boon, and they were prepared to pay 3 times as much, or, alternatively, steal it from them themselves. Sokolsky grins in return and says that obviously he's joking and would never consider such a thing, to which the demon agrees, and they both laugh again, but somewhat forced this time. The demon continues by saying that whatever else they might be, they are business people first and foremost. Marshall, Carter, and Dark always honor their commitments, which is a trait he thinks that they share with their misplaced object. Sokolsky thumps the table once and says that he definitely believes the demon is not going to try and screw him over now, asking for the other half of the payment. The bouncers proceed to lead Sokolsky through a service door and down a flight of stairs to where the club's risque clientele and expensive decor give way to an unoccupied series of brushed concrete passages. They open a door via a 2-factor keycard lock, and Sokolsky enters, finding a young woman in fashionable magician garb crouching on a table with a disproportionately large grimoire splayed over her knees. She slams it shut, causing a cloud of rainbow dust to cover her face and hair as she hops off the table and greets Sokolsky, calling him a jailer, the Serpent's Hand term for Foundation members. She introduces herself cheerfully as Agent S and asks if he's ready to play. Sokolsky regards her with bemusement as he looks around the room, finding it covered in various unidentifiable occult paraphernalia, and asks what game they're playing. She smiles in response and twirls, stating that it's the best game, the only game, and it's going to be so much fun. She grabs his hand and pulls him deeper into the room, as Sokolsky asks if she knows that this is serious business. She pats him twice on the cheek and puts her hat on his bald head, calling him cute, and saying that they'll check out some of her coolest tricks first. Sokolsky says that he was hoping she might be able to help him out with something first, and he pulls out the IntelliWard used by the thieves. Agent S interrupts him, asking how a jailer got a Serpent's Hand IntelliWard, to which Sokolsky replies that he guesses that answers that question, and puts it away. Agent S begins rifling through nearby objects until she finds something she likes, calling them hear buds. She grabs an orange carnation out of a vase and puts it into Sokolsky's breast pocket, then grabs another and speaks into it. From Sokolsky's reaction, it's apparent that he received the message telepathically, calling them floral walkie-talkies. Agent S laughs and moves on to another object, a silver padlock in the shape of a stylized human heart. She calls this one the Monolock, mentioning how it's like in tabletop RPGs, where talking is a free action. This is like that in real life, allowing a person to make one dramatic speech, uninterrupted, on any subject you feel sufficiently passionate about, and everyone around you has to let you finish without lifting a hand against you. Sokolsky just replies that she really likes puns, but she grins and says that that's actually a portmanteau. He says that he would have called it the filibuster, but she replies that that's actually something different, attempting to find it for a moment before giving up. She explains that it adds real percussive force to any dialectical bombshell you drop. They're not giving him access to anything weapons-grade, though, as it's a library, after all, and one that really cancels your card if you kick up too much of a fuss. Sikolsky notes that it's quite the armory, though, and she could probably give MC&D a run for their blood money with all this, if she took a notion. She raises an eyebrow in response, considering him seriously for an instant before deliberately laughing it off. If she took a notion, she could take the company without lifting a finger. All of this is just her hobby. Whatever it is he's planning, she could make it happen with nothing but her sweet smile, a kind word, and something she'd rather not say. She swore off the easy way a long time ago, though, and it's no fun anyways. Her smile falters, and she remarks that she's got a lot of fun to catch up on. Sikolsky asks if she's not happy with MC&D, as he's sure that they could find a place for someone with her talents at the Foundation. She suddenly snaps in response, telling him that she's sure she could find room up his ass to stuff his own head if he tries. With that, the conversation closes. Now Sikolsky's team is entirely assembled, and the seven of them meet in Area 09, the ETRA headquarters located in Nevada. Dr. McDoctorate, Director Hishikaku, Researcher Harkness, Dr. Moncier, Dr. Sumerian, Dr. Weddle, and Agent S all gather in front of Dr. Sikolsky, with a projection of SCP-8888 on the wall behind him. Sikolsky welcomes them all, and says that they all know his name, and they all know why they're here, because he wanted them to be, so that they can do what he tells them, and they can get what he wants, which is SCP-8888. McDoctorate corrects him to mean that this is what the Foundation wants, because this is the single most important piece of containment equipment in existence. Sikolsky replies that the best indication of what he means is what he says, and asks for a show of hands of who knows what SCP-8888 is. Hishikaku, McDoctorate, and Moncier raise their hands, to which Sikolsky says is good, as he really didn't want to have to shoot anyone. He emphasizes that if any of them ever tell anyone what he's about to tell them, they will be shot. But luckily they don't have to worry about that, as he knows for a fact that they're all rock solid. Harkness asks why he said it if they don't have to worry about it, and Sikolsky tells him that he wants them to be worried in general. Sumerian remarks that he's going to start writing him up right now, but Sikolsky continues, stating that this device, the 8-Ball, is worth more than all their lives put together, and maybe as much as his. He says that he won't bore them with the technical specifications, despite Hishikaku and McDoctorate objecting, and Weddle chimes in, with Sumerian asking him how he ended up here anyway. Weddle replies that he just kinda got swept along, and he glances around the room, asking Sikolsky who exactly he was picking up at the meeting at Site-43. Sumerian yells that he didn't pick up anybody, and he made him go to that meeting, where no one knew who he was. Sikolsky moves on, stating that they are gathered here today to plan a daring heist to steal back the 8-Ball, which has been stolen by parties unknown thanks to the stunning leadership and impeccable preparation of Director Hishikaku, calling for a round of applause. Hishikaku swears at him, as Agent S asks why he's here if it's his fault, but Moncier says that he will be useful. Hishikaku, in turn, asks why the Skip is here, SCP-7000, although Sumerian tells him that he can just use their names, as Skip is an unprofessional and unethical pejorative. Sikolsky explains that Weddle is here for the opposite reason that Hishikaku gets to tag along, because he will be useless, which will be useful for his master plan to retrieve their stolen artifact from the bowels of the Wanderer's Library. After a pause, McDoctorate says that he thought they were going there just as more of a waypoint, but Sikolsky confirms that they stole it, and that's where it is. Hishikaku remarks that he had already figured this out, with Sikolsky implying that he had inside information, and Harkness says he pictured himself more sitting on top of an elevator, cracking codes on a laptop or something, McDoctorate notes the nice Mission Impossible reference, but says that he gets squashed when the elevator goes up real fast, though. Harkness asks to confirm that this is one of those teams full of people with special abilities, with Sikorsky saying that, sure it is, with most of the ability concentrated at the top. Harkness wants to know if he's just there because of his thick skull, but Sikorsky says that they already established that as Weddle's role, and tells him that he selected him for a whole range of his abilities, which goes for all of them. McDoctorate brings a vast knowledge of pataphysics, which is good because none of the rest of them can stand it, and since he's got the best social skills in the room, as terrifying as that sounds, he'll be the point man for handling the human element as well. Weddle compares him to Paul Newman in The Sting, which McDoctorate says is not a heist, leading to a short discussion about the film. Sikorsky thanks them for their input, before continuing to say that Agent S will be supplying them with a range of magical equipment that the library's security will never detect. Dr. Moncier's expertise in historioglyphics will be vital for both locating and unlocking the vault where the 8-ball is being held. Dr. Cimmerian will be responsible for doing super important secret things he won't tell any of them about ahead of time, because that's a must for this sort of thing, although Cimmerian asks if he'll at least tell him. Sikorsky replies that the odds for that are about even, and then asks if he forgot anyone. Hishikaku mentions himself, to which Sikorsky just says, excellent, and moves on to code names, stating that he shouldn't have to tell them what the theme will be. Harkness asks why there needs to be a theme, and McDoctorate just says because of pataphysics, but asks why it has to be this theme. The theme, of course, is pool, and he says that they're stripes. Moncier will be 9-ball, Cimmerian is 10-ball, Hishikaku is 11-ball, McDoctorate is 12-ball, but he then checks his notes and glances at Weddle, saying that he forgot that they added the second idiot. He then apologizes, saying that he had to reshuffle some things. So Weddle is 13-ball, Harkness is 14-ball, and Agent S is 15-ball. 1 through 7 are the opposing force, which he'll brief them all on shortly, and their outside context problem, who really needs to stay outside the context, because he will mess things up quite a bit if it gets involved, is the 8th archivist of the Wanderer's Library. McDoctorate explains that he mind-controlled him once, as he can mind-control people, and he's also a really big bug. Sikorsky says that he's a big, red, ball-headed bug, so he's red ball, as in billiards, as in keep him out of their play area, please. Harkness asks what that leaves for Sikorsky, as that's all the balls. Sikorsky dramatically grins and lowers his head, telling them to call him Q-Ball. Weddle points at him and turns to look at the other group members, saying that that's why they're doing this entire thing. It was all for that. McDoctorate agrees, but Sikorsky says it's because 10-ball can't pronounce 11-ball's name, leading Cimmerian to butcher the pronunciation of Hishikaku's name. McDoctorate really wants to know what Hishikaku's role is going to be, to which Sikorsky explains that 11-ball will be gaining them access to the library, and once there, they're going to need to blend into the crowd. That means fancy dress attire for everybody, real expensive stuff, but they'll just take it out of their pay and they can bug admin for vouchers afterwards. Weddle remarks that he doesn't think he gets paid anymore, and Hishikaku asks if he's missing something, bringing fancy dress to the library. Sikorsky tells him that he's missing many things, but in this case, he was meant to. It's not a dramatic reveal without some buildup. They'll all be dressed to the nines on their mission to recover the 8-ball, because tomorrow night, they crash casino night at the Wanderer's Library in collaboration with the sovereign Tartarian territory of Under Vegas. He clicks to the next slide, revealing a heavily stylized poster, which mentions how you can win big. There's raffles, a bingo parlor, and a punch and ice cream social. It's located at the Wanderer's Library, taking place at the Tolling of the Fourth Tower of Suffering, and the dress code is physiologically appropriate formal attire. It's also sponsored by Infernal Under Vegas Casino Spa and Resort, MC&D, McSalty's Seafood Shed and Irish Pub, and the Mana Charitable Foundation. The group pauses, and Sokolsky quips for not everyone to clap at once, at which point Sumerian says that his big plan to steal the 8-Ball back is to make them dodge two hostile groups of interest. Sokolsky replies that the demons aren't hostile, despite how that sounds, with Agent S remarking that her boss got her free tickets to the red carpet premiere of Hocus Pocus 2, and also made them have a red carpet premiere. Sokolsky begins to explain what the real problem will be, but McDoctorate cuts him off, saying that this is how you explain a plan that's going to fail. Sokolsky agrees, and Hishikaku asks how he explains a plan that's going to succeed. Sokolsky reaches down and taps a key, saying, "like this," as the recording terminates. The next thing we're given is a transcript of some enigmatic footage, with the context being unknown. The camera location is an extremely dark cave, the stone only made visible by a sliver of light from above. A coded message in decimal reads, "The quick brown fox jumps over 13 lazy dogs." The light flickers, and the dislodging of rubble is faintly audible before it begins visibly trickling into the cavern. Multiple shrouded figures appear silhouetted against the light, with elements of their bodies refracting it where it falls. They cluster around the camera, whispering excitedly to one another in a pidgin of classical Greek and demotic. Several recorded statements are of particular note, translated to be them commenting on something that is very new, newer than now, and also very, very old. They say that it looks so lonely, but will never be alone again. The final statement is then spoken by a hunched figure, whose body is almost entirely reflective, reaching forward to presumably touch the source of the footage, and they say that it will change everything. With that, we're introduced to Operation Pickpocket, and are provided the interviews and after-action reports in a somewhat disjointed manner. The first bit of text is from Sokolsky, just asking what you think happened. Then we're given a document explaining that Class C personnel slash Infotech researcher James Harkness was recovered 3 days after the communications breakdown between members of Sokolsky's provisional task force. His station was found abandoned, and Harkness was disoriented and uncooperative with asset recovery personnel, necessitating sedation before being brought to Site 15 for questioning. The recording captures a dark space featuring a door and a small metal table. Indistinct sounds of commotion are heard in the distance, and the door swings open as Dr. Sokolsky enters, propping the door open with a wedge. He then disappears briefly before two security guards enter, dragging the limp form of Harkness behind them, flanked by an orderly writing on a clipboard. The guards toss Harkness into the seat across from Sokolsky and leave, with the orderly handing over his clipboard and pen to Sokolsky, who fills out the documents. Harkness's bloodshot eyes then widen as he recognizes Sokolsky, and his speech is slurred as he yells that he wants his phone call. Sokolsky is surprised that he's not coherent by now, and looks at the clipboard, shocked at how high the dosage was. He says that he's no use to him like this, and hands the clipboard back to the orderly, who turns and leaves the room. Harkness glances around the room and asks where he is, but Sokolsky doesn't respond, instead staring him down with an unreadable expression. A few minutes pass before the orderly returns with a white bottle with a nasal spray applicator, which Sokolsky takes. He kneels down beside Harkness and says that he's going to hate him in like 5 seconds, but they don't have time for this. Harkness continues to mutter nonsensical phrases before looking like he's about to fall asleep again. Sokolsky says that he takes enough naps during company hours and inserts the plastic nozzle into Harkness's nostril, releasing the vapor. Harkness jolts up, hits his head on the wall behind him, groans, and vomits. He swears multiple times and asks where he is and what happened. He rubs his temples and asks what happened with Casino Knight. Sikorsky explains that they had to abandon the mission, and Harkness went AWOL. They found him demanding staff members at the Planet Fitness of North Palm Beach to show him to their Foundation embassy. Harkness says that mistakes happen, and asks if he has any gum. The next bit of text is from Hrazem Kahl, who just says that, "You must admit that it mostly went to plan." So, from the sounds of it, Operation Pickpocket was not an overwhelming success, which is not a huge surprise when we consider how disjointed the team seemed to be. Combining such a variety of personalities with such a potentially dangerous event into one spectacular heist was bound to go off course, and we'll just have to see how exactly off course it went. Stay tuned for part 3, as Sikorsky wrangles his team of misfits into a casino night of hellish delights, and some more familiar faces.